Blog Talk Radio.
This is the open door. I have left an open door before you, which no one can close. This is Bob Olson, Catholic lay evangelist, along with lay evangelist Evelyn Olson and Dr. Rhonda Chervin, noted Catholic philosopher, author, and college professor. The open door is open to growing in love, open to the love of God, and open to joining His stream of love for others.
And we'd like to wish you a wonderful, wonderful welcome on the open door. Dr. Rhonda Chervin will not be with us tonight. She has a class that she's working on. But Richard, Dr. Richard in Birmingham, Alabama, is with us, and Commander Al Hughes in Corpus Christi, Texas. And Dr. Richard is in charge of the subject tonight. We talked a little bit about it in our pre-game. But we're ready to go now, Dr. Richard, on what you're presenting tonight.
Okay. Oh, all right. We're on the air then. All right. Tonight's topic would be on the apocalypse. Now, in 1873, Blessed John Henry Newman wrote a sermon predicting an apocalypse. But it was not the apocalypse that written by St. John the Evangelist in the Bible. That would be the end of the world. But he used the term apocalypse to cover what he considered a major break in Western civilization. Now, in that major break, the Catholic Church would be isolated as she had never been isolated before in her long history. That means she'd even be more isolated than she was when she started in the Roman Empire. So that's a mouthful. Now, the second part of this break would be a total rejection of the tradition of the ancient Greeks and Romans, who set the foundations for Western civilization with their notion of man and their notion of science and things like that. He saw there'd be a total break from that. And in its stead would be like the modern university devoting all its energy in the sciences, doctors, lawyers, and all that, for the building of a heaven on earth now. Okay, now the question to the panel is this. You're all of an age where you have some years behind you. When you were a young person, did you feel you were living in an apocalyptic age? Now, Newman predicted it in 1873. Well, I mean, here we are in the 20th century. What did you think were a young person? Just to give you an idea, I'll start off, okay? So I was born in 1932, and when I was a young man, oh, let's say in the 1960s, I figured, well, the times are looking pretty good. The United States had just beaten the godless Nazis, and we're facing down the atheistic communists and the Catholic Church. Why, we just had a president elected, President Kennedy, a Catholic, and this Catholic school system was going along great. You know, why shouldn't it get better? So I was not certainly thinking I was living in an age of an apocalypse. Okay, so I don't know, Bob, what was your impression when you were a young man, you know, by the time of the 1960s?
Well, you and I were, you know, pretty close there, because I was born in 31. You were born in 32.
Okay, so, right. So we're of an age.
And,
go ahead.
Now, the thing was that I didn't become a Catholic until 1981, so it took me 50 years. become a Catholic.
All right, so
I don't know if I was thinking so much about that, what was going to happen there. I thought, you know, when I heard things like, when I was reading about things like good will be considered bad, bad will become good, and good will become bad, and I thought I'd never see things like that, like we're seeing today. So, I had some concerns. I mean, I didn't have any concerns at that time.
Things
like were looking pretty good.
So you'd be a typical American and pretty confident in America, I guess. Any American dream, I suppose, right?
Mm-hmm. And, they were still saying prayers at the city council meetings and at the public meetings and so forth. So, everything seemed to be okay.
Okay. All right. Commander, what was your reading when you were a young man?
Well, I too was not a Catholic until much later, but I wasn't aware of anything that anybody would call an apocalypse, but I do recall in high school, that's the middle 50s, that I really desperately wanted a course in Latin, and it was not to be found anywhere. It had already been stripped out of all of the schools anywhere around where I was. And my mother used to talk about her Latin experience and the fact that she could fake her way in four different Romance languages just because she had had Latin. It's something I always wanted, and it had already been stripped out of the curriculum for schools. And the other point I would make, you mentioned the good is bad and bad is good kind of a approach that's happening in the culture. That comes from George Orwell's 1984 doublespeak. And if you want to doublespeak, just flip on the TV and listen to any politician today, and you'll get doublespeak. You'll see what that's all about.
Exactly.
To the highest level. Pardon?
His books were scary to me.
Yeah, I used to look forward to that and say it's going to be awful by the time we get to 1984. Well. He was right, but he was off by about 30 years. But he was right. It's here now and getting worse, by the day.
Yeah, and Orwell did spell it out. Then he spelled it out, but not even in primarily religious terms, but in very human terms, the effect on human beings in community. Well, okay, so that's the way we were. Go ahead.
The other thing that I'm aware of, even when I was in high school, middle 50s, we had some very good history courses. And my understanding is that much of history has been ripped out of the school curriculums and replaced with political advocacy ideas in place of history. Which is terribly damaging, because now you listen to the young people on Waters World on TV. He interviews the young people. They haven't got a clue as to their past and what's going on now. They just haven't got the richness of history set in their minds.
And what Newman, this is in 1873, way back then, he sensed this coming. And there was a certain foreboding about it. And the thing that struck him is that it had come to the universities, and it'd take a while. But from what you're saying, Al, that there was still a sense of history. Yeah, and there was, the way I was brought up in a parochial school system, a very strong sense of history. Well, today, I mean, we might as well get into the way we see things today. You get Yeah, in Waters World, you have them visiting the various college students at the various resorts. No sense of history. I mean, like American history?
Yeah, and they don't know what's going on right now either.
No, they could care less, see? And Newman would say what you're looking at is a catastrophe, but it doesn't appear, it appears as just sheer ignorance of the past. And that is a catastrophe. It's going to be trouble. Well, it is trouble already. See, but that's getting us into the way we see things now. And what we're seeing is a collapse of what I guess formerly atheists and agnostics and religious people and Jews would take for granted, you know, like things in American history or things in European history. That's gone. And
you mentioned about Hitler and about the German, efforts to cause problems. I've seen interviews recently interviewing young people and don't even know who Adolf Hitler was. They have
that's
no
right.
idea.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You know, the
know
importance of history. I have in the book I'm writing. I've got a quote from the psychologist Carl Jung. Has to do with the importance of history. He writes, and it's just a short comment here. He was a psychologist, right? The psychologists of today ought to realize once and for all that we are no longer dealing with questions of dogma and creed. A religious attitude is an element of psychic life whose importance can hardly be overrated. And here's the key. And it is precisely for the religious outlook that the sense of historical continuity is indispensable.
And that's quite true. And here's, let's add this other thing. Let's leave religion, the Christendom, the Catholic Church out of it. And just look at the ancient Greeks and Romans. Now, we call them pagan, rightfully so. But, and this is what's intriguing, the pagans had a strong sense of they being the mortals, subject to death, and the immortals, the gods, really ran things. So even in the pagan culture, there was a sense of an afterlife, of a judgment, that this earth could not be a heaven. It was a preparation for the afterlife, and there you had either a place of reward for the virtuous or punishment for the wicked. Now, this is pagan. See? Paganism, this element was in paganism. So when you're just talking about a liberal education or trying to get a sense of history, if you were deep in the classics, like Al, it was interesting, you're looking for that. I guess your mother, I mean, she had talked about it. There was something in the classics profoundly human. And in Newman's day, Oxford would be the center of classical learning, you know, Latin and Greek. And I guess enough of it was covered by your mother. So I don't know how you would classify your mother religiously, but I mean, I guess you would classify her as a classicist, and a classicist would have this sense of you can't have a heaven on earth. You know, there's an afterlife. So that's, and ordinarily we don't look upon the pagans that way. We look upon the pagans as opposed to Christianity, and it's wine, women, and song, and shoot the works, and don't worry about the future. The classics, Plato, were a lot more serious about the afterlife and a sense of justice and a certain kind of politics. So when you miss out on the classics, you're in deep, deep trouble. But who would know that? Who would recognize it? See, this is, it'd be a sneaky apocalypse. It just slides away.
Yeah, it's not being taken by force, necessarily.
Nope, nope. No, you don't need Hitler, you don't need Stalin shooting people.
No. Right. And this question is probably too simple, but do you think that, you know, that's the reason for all the suicides we're hearing about lately? The idea there's no hope, I mean, this is it. This, you know, this earth is the end, and it doesn't look very good to me. You know, would a person say that?
Well, see, the irony is a culture, science, being presumptuous enough to think they can create a heaven on earth, which the ancient pagans were never that silly to think. We have thought of it in a great kind of pride or arrogance, and I guess Orwell spells it out. What is it like when the God is out of it and some great ruler or big brother is in charge of it? And what you get, and Orwell, a pretty good, you get a picture of hell. I mean, a pretty frightening concrete picture of hell. So I think a lot of people are living with that sense of isolation and hell, and the young especially are feeling it. So we're postmodern in that sense. But go ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting. Bob brought up the question of suicide. I didn't read the first sentence of that quote from Carl Jung, and it goes like this. Experience shows that many neuroses are caused by the fact that people blind themselves to their own religious promptings because of childish passion for rational enlightenment.
That's
and
it.
And that's where we are, I think. The rational enlightenment,
yeah,
course comes out of the Newman's time. He was speaking against the age of enlightenment. And so it all kind of ties together, doesn't it?
Yes.
And neuroses, of course, neuroses then can lead to psychoses, can lead to a suicide, which completes Bob's thought.
Well, a sociopath or a guy getting an inspiration and then getting a gun and shooting some cops before he shoots himself, and all the, you know, these mass killings. And the...
Yeah.
See, and we had, even with the pagans, with the classical, a barrier against that. In other words, see, Newman's contention is man is by nature religious. And it didn't take Christianity to do that, because if man is by nature religious, man by nature has a conscience, because by nature he has reason, which means he's not an irrational animal. So even today, and this is the point, if that's true about human nature, even today, people have a conscience. But there's a war against the conscience, and it's beaten down. And then there's a sense of guilt or despair or hopelessness. So it isn't, if conscience is part of nature, you can't rub it out. I mean, you can suppress it or repress it, but it can't be rubbed out. So what you have is a lot of hurting consciences, guilty consciences living life, and therefore people filled with resentment and hatred.
And when you go to the scriptures, that's where you find your hope. And if you don't have that, if you don't have those, where are you going to find this hope?
Mm-hmm.
That's where I find it.
Well, the strange thing is you have these ISIS people, and they're going around cutting off people and crucifying Christians and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And you say it don't make sense. They're just provoking us into doing something about it. But the angle that someone brought out was this. You get those hardcore Muslim fanatics, and of course they're filled with hatred of Christianity. Really, the rest of the human race that doesn't think like them. They're filled with that. And what they're doing is appealing to a lot of people who are already filled with resentment and all that. And they'd be over here in the West. And then, and they experience, and this is mind-boggling to us, you get young people, they'll get on a plane, they have passports, they'll end up in the Near East, and they'll join up with the ISIS people, and what? They can do there whatever they damn well please. Chop off heads, shoot people, this and that, play out things they can't do here. See, here, if they do it, all right, they get arrested or killed and so on. But over there, you can do it in a group. And you have power then. Now you're a powerful person acting on your instincts. And the ISIS people seem to be playing to that. There's a vacuum here, and it isn't just dull. It's filled with resentment and hatred. And ISIS is saying, hey, we'll give you an outlet for this, and we're going to be the winners. Because look how helpless the soft West is in the face of what we're doing to it. We're spitting in its eye, and they got to take it. And you can be in there spitting and shooting away and be on top of things. You say, well, that's a pretty devilish appeal. Well, it seems to be playing out.
Well, like someone was pointing out yesterday, that actually this is nothing new for the for those people. I mean, they've been doing this, you know, for years, right? But now they're publicizing it more, using some of these new techniques of, you know, television and internet and so forth, and they're publishing all this stuff, and they're intimidating people with it, with the publicity.
Yeah, formerly the Muslim world wasn't that technologically powerful and so on. So the West dominated it by its sheer technological superiority. But now
they have the technology.
Right, and they don't have to mount up a big army to do it. Just strap a few bombs to people and blow up people and just scare the hell out of everybody, see? And
that's right.
What do other Muslims do? They got to take it. So that's it. This is an appeal to a rather satanic pride. You can do what you damn well please and get away with it. That's frightening.
Now, Al, you said when we were talking about this before we went on the air that one of the things that you're working, one of the things that is happening in your new book is the apocalypse of indifference that you're writing
I can go a little bit on that. I was right as you were talking, asking me. I was looking at a quote by Martin Kelsey, who I think he wrote this in the 50s or possibly in the 60s. It's very short. Probably the foremost reason most people today cannot believe in God is that modern Western man has let his ability to know, his idea of science, mislead him into doubting the existence of any reality which he cannot touch or understand. Non-material reality, then, cannot exist. And that's, of course, that's what comes out of this whole age of enlightenment, is Comte's philosophy of positivism, that if we can't prove it scientifically, then it doesn't exist. That's the public understanding of those philosophies, and that's what I'm writing about. That's in my several chapters of the book I'm working on. But that's really the core of the problem, is the understanding of the idea of positivism, which is that only scientifically proven objects, if you will, can exist. And of course, science has never been able to, in the past, to prove that there was God or to even indicate the, such. And I write about that as well and why that is, has been true. Ironically, just as people are running to that positivist outlook, ironically, as they're doing that, science has finally, statistically, essentially proven the existence of God. And that's really what the first half of my book is all about. I don't think I can go into all of that, but statistically, they've shown,
yeah.
Astrophysicists have now shown that there must have been a thinking, designing creator, transcendent creator, before the beginning of the universe, who designed the universe. And statistically, they can show that because of the fine-tuning of all of the physical constants required for a life-supporting universe. Anyway, that's the topic I'm working on right now. And here, I'll throw in unpaid commercial here for Dr. Robert Spitzer, Spitzer. He has a book out titled "New." Okay, you know about it. New Proofs for the Existence of God. And the subtitle is Contributions of Contemporary Physics and Philosophy. A sketch of his book is in my sixth chapter that I just finished. I'll say it again. New Proofs for the Existence of God by Robert J. Spitzer, Spitzer.
That's available now.
Excuse me. Pardon?
That's available
say again?
Now.
It's
no,
out,
see,
it's out there. I think it's copyrighted in 12, so yes, it's out.
All right, one question I have for you, Al. You're in the military, so that right away is a pretty traditional outfit with a whole way of looking at things. But you were doing a lot of scientific work. All right, now what was driving you when you were doing a lot of this scientific work or technology? What was the mindset you had as you were doing it?
Are you talking about before my conversion?
Yeah, right.
Okay. Excuse me, dry throat. I guess the quickest way to answer that question is a very short story. In my senior year studying to be an electrical engineer, I was walking across the campus between a couple of dormitories, and in my thinking, I committed myself to service. I had a strong feeling of gratitude. Didn't know who to put that one on. So the highest calling I knew at the time was the Air Force, because my dad had been in the Air Force. So I committed myself in service to the Air Force as a 20-year-old. And of course that now transfers to God. After my wife and I had our miraculous experiences in our conversions, we committed ourselves to obedience to God and in service of God. So I had always wanted to serve, at least from age 20. And so that was my attitude toward the Air Force until the conversion came.
And the Air Force deals a lot in technology. The big bombers, jets, communications, and all that business. And there's always plenty to learn on it, communications and all that. So you could say it could fill a person's scope, service, without maybe a deep sense of religion, but carrying a person. And I imagine there are a lot of people that have been carried that way in the past. And although I think now... Well, you wonder what carries these Navy SEALs.
I don't know what it's like on active duty now, but when I was in, this might surprise some people, the military was a very religious outfit because of the tradition. It was all about tradition and honor, duty, honor, country. And behind all of that was a religious feeling of of support for you know, for family and country. And I don't know what it's like now, but that's the way it was when I was in. So it was common to pray, you know, before exercises or before we did things. There was a great deal of religious style ceremony in everything that we did, at least in the formal, you know, formal sense.
Yeah. And I know the Marines have a pretty religious tradition because they're the ones who do a lot of dying. And they have
they
a tradition
still speak Latin,
of people,
right?
Right,
they still
right,
speak Latin, Semper Fi.
That's right. And it gives you a view of the of people really close to death and being the shock troops and living with that, giving
there's
your life
lot,
to the country.
Yeah, there's an old saying: there are no atheists in foxholes.
No, at least they didn't seem to be in the Marines anyway.
Yeah.
Well, just in closing, you talk about Dr. Spitzer, and I've heard one of his talks at the, I may have mentioned this before, one of his talks at the Napa Valley Conference this year, and where he says that until a person realizes that he has a need for Jesus, okay, until he realizes he has a need for Jesus, no matter what you talk to him about Christianity, it isn't going to mean anything. So
yeah, he has to have a need.
Well,
or
that's
a
good point. That was exactly the beginning of my own conversion. You know, when I felt a need, and it was the first time I prayed. I didn't get an answer for 4 years, but I did get an answer to my prayer, and that's when the serious conversion started.
Uh-huh.
Yep, there you are. Well,
that's all
that
in
book,
my first
so it's
book.
Available. That book by Spitzer sounds very intriguing.
Yeah, please
new
do.
For
oh, by the way,
okay.
Yeah, as we close, Kiki was on last week, and I sent her a copy of my book. She's got it.
Oh, yeah, no,
the
she
first
was
one.
On the week before. Remember we had the fellow from Steubenville on that we couldn't talk to, and he was a little hard to understand. And was his phone breaking up once in a while?
I heard some
like
breakup.
Huh?
Yeah. That was Alain Saray. He's got a thick accent, but I'm used to it.
Yeah. Well, next week we're going to talk about that material that you sent us in the email, and go back and forth with Dr. Richard on that, possibly, and maybe Rhonda before we decide, huh?
Right. I'll do email and give some ideas. I just want to figure out how to approach that subject in the best way.
Okay. Well,
okay.
Father in heaven, we thank you and praise you for this time together, and we thank you for calling us here tonight. We thank you for allowing us to answer the call to be here on a very, very, very interesting subject that is so timely today. And thank you, Dr. Richard, for bringing that up. And thank you, Commander Al. And we'll see you next week, same time, same station, on the Open Door. In the meantime, may God bless each and every one of you. In Jesus' name, amen.
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 Amen.